When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following is a special presentation of Alpha Media. Welcome to Beyond the Headlines, in-depth interviews on topics of concern here in Portland and the Northwest. Now, here's your host, Brett Recap.
Well, good day. Thank you very much, and welcome into the 505th edition of Beyond the Headlines, a behind-the-scenes look at some of the stories making news here in the Pacific Northwest and beyond as we move through this month of February 2024 on all seven of our Alpha Media Portland radio stations, including FM News 101. All right, the weather is taking a turn, and that's where we start this week. If you were around here last February, you might remember that surprise snowstorm we dealt with. That was February 22nd. That brought us over 10 inches of snow. It was insane. So it doesn't look like we're going to get anything like that here in 2024, but things have been awfully nice this past week, so it might feel quite a bit different as things turn. Here is how a weather interview sounded on Friday morning on KXL with Veronica and me. All right, the weather around here is a-changing as this weekend moves along. Here to talk about the shifting patterns is meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Portland, Brianna Muhlstein. Brianna, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it. So you guys are busy, we're guessing, watching this cold front. When do you expect it to hit?
Yeah, so over the weekend, we'll kind of have this offshore flow. So it'll be nice this weekend, but moving into next week, we're definitely going to have a big shift in our pattern. Starting on Sunday, we'll be having a favorable northwest flow pattern over us. So we'll be having cool and showery conditions throughout the week. Snow levels will be dropping Sunday about 1,000 to 1,500 feet with some areas at or below 500 feet. So looking at a rain, snow across the region. For the lowlands, which everyone's kind of interested in, on Monday, we're looking at really light snow accumulations, probably wet, less than an inch, probably just light accumulations on non-paved grassy surfaces. And again, we might have that same condition occurring later in the week. We will have some light accumulations across the Coast Range. One interesting part of the week will be possibly snow levels rising a little bit and getting heavy rain across the Coast Range, which could impact some rivers. So we'll be watching that closely. But the big story is going to be for the Cascades and Cascade Foothills. Snow levels will be about 3,000 feet throughout the week. And so between Sunday and Thursday, we're looking right now in our forecast, we've got about 5 to 6 feet of snow in the Cascades during that time. And with that snow, we're going to be having some pretty gusty winds. So those who are going up to the ski mountain, it's going to be great snow accumulations. But at the same time, we're going to be having some pretty gusty winds up there, especially those who are driving over the passes. So reduced visibility is going to be a major concern for those traveling. Yeah, that's kind of our big story. And it's going to be just accumulating snow across the Cascades, looks like, into next weekend in our long-range models.
Even if you're not heading to the Cascades, we could see enough on the roads and lower elevations to make driving a little dicey, correct?
Yeah, so we can be seeing some snow accumulations, you know, around 1,000 feet at times throughout the week. And so you don't have to be fully in the Cascades and the high Cascades to be having impactful driving.
Okay, yeah, and you're saying it's going to last a little bit longer than we might have thought. Is that the case? Like, you know, Sunday, Monday, all the way through the bulk of next week in terms of extra wet weather and pretty cold.
Yeah, so we're going to be having our snow accumulations are going to be pretty high Monday into Tuesday. We'll have a little bit of a lull occurring Wednesday in, like, the Coast Range and the lowlands, but the Cascades are going to continue to get snow pretty much all week long. We don't really see too much of a break. The accumulations will become a little bit lighter on Wednesday, but then they're going to ramp back up near the end of the week or towards the end of the week.
So if you've been itching to do something fun outdoors, or maybe you got some yard work you got to catch up on, today or tomorrow's it?
Yeah, that would be my recommendation.
And another point in that is don't plant anything right now, because it looks like those little plants are going to freeze all next week.
Probably, especially if you're in, you know, the Coast Range and the foothills.
All right. That's excellent info. Brianna, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That is Brianna Buhlstein, meteorologist with the National Weather Service here in Portland. There is never a bad time to talk about systemic racism, but here in February, it is more appropriate than ever, especially as it pertains to homeownership remains sadly out of reach for many people, especially Black Americans. Real estate expert Rick Sadel with Keller Williams Realty and SadelRealEstate.com is with us. Good morning, Rick.
Hey, good morning.
So February is Black History Month in the U.S., and we have a new report to talk about from LendingTree. What are some of the top line stats for African Americans and homeownership?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you said, there's a new report from LendingTree that I looked at. And what they did is they analyzed the Census Bureau's 2022 American Community Survey. And that study ranks the 50 largest metro areas in the difference between the percentage of owner-occupied homes that identify as Black and the share of the area's population that identify as Black. Well, in the report, it shows that the Black people make up almost 15% of the population. And in studying those 50 largest metro areas, only made up 10% of homeowners. One area, for example, Memphis, Tennessee, Black people made up almost half the population and only about 36% of the homes in the area do they own. So it's definitely, it's a huge disparity.
Okay, so are Black people still facing disproportionate hurdles for home ownership, according to LendingTree?
Yeah, I mean, according to that same report, one of the biggest hurdles is the income disparity. The median income for Black U.S. households is a little over $50,000, while the median income for white households is almost $80,000. Obviously, that makes it a lot harder to afford a home, and they also tend to have less household wealth and then, of course, less access to generational wealth.
Understood. The law doesn't allow for discrimination based on race in housing from any angle here. So how does this problem get better?
Right. Great question. I wish I had a great answer. As you said, it's not legal to discriminate based on race and housing, although I know it still happens. What it really comes down to is the wage differences, right? And hopefully there's people way smarter than me that'll work to solve that problem.
Down payment still, is that the biggest hurdle here for people of color and really all individuals and families looking to break through into that homeownership bracket?
Yeah, definitely people of color and all people, like you said, it's definitely the biggest hurdle. Even for those families that can afford the monthly payments for the house that they can and want to live in, it's really hard for those families to save up enough money for the down payment. And now, while there are some down payment assistance programs out there, there are not very many, and a lot of people don't even know about them, right? There's not a huge advertising budget for those programs.
It's a systemic problem in the country. It's been going on for decades. Hopefully, we're getting better as we move into the later years here in 2024 and beyond. Rick, thanks for your perspective.
Yeah, thanks.
That is Rick Sadel, real estate expert with Keller Williams Realty and SadelRealEstate.com. The Gresham City Council wants Multnomah County to adopt a new policy about their stance on how AMR staffs ambulances. The county chair put out a plan this week that holds the line on her rule of making sure all calls are staffed with two paramedics and not one paramedic and one EMT. The Gresham City Council passed a resolution demanding the county make a change. It's a standoff between the company that provides ambulance services and the Multnomah County chair that has sharpened into a deeper divide. We have the story covered in a couple of different ways. We'll start with KXL's Annette Newell, as she reports that this could impact what happens when your family members need an ambulance.
Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson insists that American Medical Response, or AMR, must live up to its contract and provide two paramedics per ambulance.
We have been patiently working with AMR, acknowledging the unique challenges facing our county right now. We have tried to exhaust every option, but they need to do their part. AMR must immediately assign more paramedics to work in Multnomah County and provide incentives to hire and keep people working in Multnomah County.
However, the company says it's disappointed with Chair Vega Peterson's statement and says, quote, "We are in crisis and the chair is ignoring the facts. We need an actual plan that is attainable in the post-pandemic national paramedic shortage we find ourselves in." And some local governments agree with AMR's plan to staff ambulances with one paramedic and one lesser-trained EMT. The Gresham City Council voted unanimously to demand the county adopt a one-paramedic, one-EMT model, and in a letter from the Northeast Multnomah Community Association leaders in the Corbett area say, quote, "The desire to hold on to the two-paramedic ambulance staffing is threatening the health of the overall community." Annette Newell, FM News 101.
Thanks, Annette. And on Portland's Morning News, Veronica and I spoke with a member of the Gresham City Council, Vince Jones Dixon, to hear what he had to say about their city's resolution.
Well, as we've been covering a lot this week, there's been debate about how many paramedics have to be on each emergency call in Multnomah County. The problem is there's not enough of them. People are having to wait to be taken to the hospital. Gresham City Council members are asking for a solution that means getting people in for an emergency care ASAP. Joining us now is Councilman Vince Jones Dixon. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yep. Good morning, Veronica, Fred. Thank you for having me.
Well, kind of run down what it is that Gresham is asking for in this.
Pretty simply, we're asking for just transport after we've stabilized our community members out here in East Multnomah County in a solution.
Understood. Could you maybe expand on the resolution that you made?
Yeah, it's pretty simply what we've been finding over the last couple of years, even when I got onto the city council, the response times have been extremely, have been dismal. And we've been asking the county to, if we can work with them to come up with a solution, even a temporary one.
Now, we talked to Portland Fire earlier this morning, and they have one paramedic on each fire truck that goes out. What is the situation in Gresham? Is it a similar thing? Because the rule is here for Multnomah County, it has to be two paramedics on the truck.
Yeah. We have the same. I know for the AMR ambulance response, they have two paramedics on one rig. And for us, on all of our fire rigs, we have one paramedic at the very least.
But they are trained. Your firefighters are trained as EMTs, correct?
Yes, EMTs and one paramedic on each shift, on each truck.
Gresham City Councilman Vince Jones Dixon is with us. So during your conversations last night with your colleagues, what was the conversation like and how did you end up at this decision to make a resolution?
We listened to our firefighters and our first responders and to the community as well. It was a unanimous decision, and it's a conversation that we've been having for the last year and a half as a council. So it was very, very simple. We hope that the county will move in that direction in close pace.
Because, you know, as we've been hearing from people who have suffered emergencies, they want some immediate help, you know, whether or not it's an EMT or a paramedic at that critical moment isn't what they're thinking about. It's somebody help me right now.
Yeah, that is correct. And our firefighters, we do respond immediately. The issue is transport to the hospital. So that already happens. It's just providing the transport to the medical facility. That's the issue.
So where do you think this goes from here? Gresham is one city that is in Multnomah County, along with Portland. Do you have any kind of time frame, or do you think that this resolution will be received in any way?
I believe that we won't know until the meeting next week. I'm hoping that we will be able to move forward with some solution or resolution from the county within here shortly or immediately. And then we can figure out the long-term just strategy as far as getting more medics in the pipeline for transport and for the fire department.
Have you heard any stories from people yet, you know, any tragedies that might have happened because they had to wait?
Yes, I have, unfortunately. As far as the wait times, yesterday, if you've listened to our council meeting, there's a story of a lady that was, she was pregnant and she got shot, unfortunately, and our paramedics or our fire department, they were able to get her stable, and they were planning on transporting her to the hospital in the fire engine because of the estimated response time from the ambulance service. But ultimately, the ambulance service, they ended up making an adjustment and prioritizing that call, and they came. I believe she was waiting for almost 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's what everyone's trying to avoid, obviously. And then the Gresham, you mentioned that you had heard from firefighters. What is the
Correct.
Gresham Fire Department saying and other local, firefighters and frontline people?
One, they're supportive of the resolution. They are the first. I mean, our union president brought it to myself and our council again about a year and a half ago, and he has engaged in conversations with the county, and they just want to be a part of the conversation as far as creating a solution for all of the residents here in Multnomah County, especially our residents here in East Multnomah County.
If Multnomah County doesn't loosen the rules a little bit, are there options for you guys? I mean, do you have to just pay for a second paramedic? What would the city do?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm looking to get briefed on that from our chief.
Understood. I tell you what, it's an ongoing situation, and we can't thank you enough for being on with us and talking a little bit about it. Vince, thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Brett. And thank you, Veronica.
Take Absolutely. Care. That is Vince Jones-Dixon, councilman for Gresham City Council. And from there, Portland Fire and Rescue was up next on Portland's Morning News about this topic.
Well, there's been an ambulance emergency locally. American Medical Response can always provide two paramedics on each and every call, which is required by Multnomah County. That means they sometimes can't get to you as fast as possible during an emergency. AMR wants the county to loosen those rules and allow EMTs to also go out on the calls. Rick Graves with Portland Fire and Rescue joins us now live. Good morning, Rick. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Well, there's a lot of back and forth on this, and we're curious about your agency's take on this, because you guys get called on these.
Certainly, yeah. You know, we respond to all triaged ALS, advanced life support calls that we get dispatched to, and at times there is not an ambulance available to transport an individual to the hospital.
Gotcha. Maybe you could help tell us the difference, Rick, between a paramedic and an EMT, and maybe what the difference is, you know, once they arrive on scene.
Sure. An EMT basic has a bit of medical knowledge and can do some, just as it says, basic medical interventions in the field. But nothing significant as a paramedic. They have 18 months more training and a significant amount more oversight with their medical interventions, and they can perform lots of other interventions. They can start IVs. They can give, you know, up to 13 medications based on the situation. It could be a trauma. It could be a cardiac arrest. It could be a diabetic situation. Many of these critical interventions that occur in the field require a paramedic. Every single fire engine and truck within the city of Portland has a paramedic on it, along with a support cast of basics. So upon our arrival, we're able to make situations, but at some point in time, field service needs to get transported to the hospital. And with a low availability of ambulances, it just makes it difficult and critical for some of these patients that we're seeing on the streets.
I mean, everybody wants the best of the best when it comes to taking care of yourself or your loved ones. But, I mean, an EMT is better than your neighbor, you know, helping you during an emergency crisis.
Unless your neighbor is an ED doc. Yeah, you're probably right. Exactly. You know, a little bit of training goes a long ways. In particular, we always show up as a team, and we train as a team. We're you know, a well-oiled machine, if you will. So upon arrival, we have a lot of basics who could recognize the significance of a situation, know the protocols, begin to get the medicines ready for the paramedic to administer based on what's being presented. So our field interaction in these situations is very, very successful. It's just a matter of sometimes we have to get creative and get an individual to a hospital based on the situation that's being presented with a reduced number of available transporting ambulances.
I see. So you already have one paramedic when Portland Fire and Rescue goes out to a scene and not two. Is that the case generally?
That is correct. On all our rigs, we carry a single paramedic. There are some rigs in the city that have they have two paramedics with Portland Fire and Rescue. Based on our staffing situation, we have specialty teams where you have an officer that may be a paramedic, as well as a firefighter that may be a paramedic. So on occasion, we do have some staffed rigs that will have two paramedics on scene immediately. The importance, as I understand it, from the county EMS office is to have two paramedics in the transporting rig in the event that there is a need for that on scene and in transport. So that's where we are.
What about the emotional toll? It must be really hard when you're trying to save someone's life and there's no ambulance available.
It can get a little uncomfortable, and that's when our crews will start to get creative, and we have the ability to, you know, with these handheld devices, we have apps that can show us maybe locations of ambulances along with where we are in a line. And sometimes the call has been made simply to get the patient to the hospital in an alternative treatment vehicle. But some of these interventions require the security and safety and the setup of a specific ambulance, of which we don't have in Portland Fire. You know, we could do it in the back of a fire engine. We could do it in the back of a chief's rig, if you will. In some of our two-person rescues that have a bench seat behind, we can do it. And obviously, there's been other mechanisms we've used. We've walked patients with gurneys. We've taken a bus. But we're just trying to make sure that we're able to get the citizens that we respond to or the members of the community within our response area, when we respond to them and there's an emergent need to get them to the hospital, there's a successful mechanism to do so, and that is the back of an ambulance.
And we are truly grateful for you, all of our frontline workers. Is there anything else you want to say on this topic as government agencies, frontline workers like yourselves go back and forth? Meanwhile, nothing stops out there in the public.
Right. You know, hospitals and fire stations never close, right? There's always an emergency. So we're hopeful that the parties that are involved with making these decisions are going to get to the table and meet and create a pathway to providing more available ambulances for those that are in need in and around the Multnomah County area specifically.
Rick, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us this morning.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
All right. That's Rick Graves with Portland Fire.
Huge thanks there to both Rick Graves with Portland Fire and Rescue and Vince Jones Dixon with the Gresham City Council for providing some perspective on this tug of war between Multnomah County and AMR. You're listening to the 505th edition of Beyond the Headlines. I'm your host, Brett Recamp. A lot of news in cyberspace this week. We talked about it on Friday with our cybersecurity expert. The federal government says a cyber attack on a port like PDX could do more damage than a major storm. With us now, cybersecurity expert, author, and president of the New York-based Information Technology Management Group, Chris Moscovides. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. How's everybody doing?
Excellent. Before we talk about this executive order, what is happening with the cell phone situation with AT&T? We're hearing that it's not a cyber attack. Are you looking into that at all?
Yes. Not only me, but everybody's looking into that. It was a massive failure, and it is a very suspicious massive failure. Although currently there is no evidence or no announcements that this was the cause of caused by a cyber attack, there's a lot of people that suspect that it was. So we're all waiting to hear what the official response is going to be on this.
But phones are back, so that's the good news.
So, yeah, phones are mostly back.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about PDX. I mean, we can forgive, it's annoying, but we can forgive if a storm hits and your plane can't take off. But if it's a bad guy making it where nobody can get to where they're going and they've already paid for their vacations, well, I don't know about the rest of them, but I'm going to be pretty angry.
and you should be. So it is both a conversation about the airport and and the conversation about the port. And, you know, in cybersecurity, one of the things that we do is try to understand what is the value of the asset that you are protecting. So when we're talking about PDX, the port, we need to understand that this thing is the fifth largest auto import gateway in the country. And it is the largest mineral bulk import in the West Coast. It moves over 17 million tons of cargo every year. This is a major facility. Disrupting that facility will damage the United States in a very serious way. Raw materials are not going to be there. All sorts of shipments may be misdirected or lost. Equipment that have a life expectancy, medicines, things like that, could be stuck in a port for months, becoming useless. So this is a very, very serious threat.
Got it. And the Biden administration is trying to do something about it when it comes to cyber attacks in our ports. What's happening there?
Well, from where I stand, not a moment too soon. what they're trying to do is they're looking at every sector of mission critical infrastructure in the United States, and they're trying to create regulations at the federal level to protect those installations. These are ports, these are airports, these are sewer systems, electrical grids. And the problem in the United States is that there are all of these things tend to be run by private operators, and it's fragmented, and each of these private operators has their own agenda to make money. So they are not necessarily going to be focusing in protecting or spending money in cybersecurity. So the federal regulations are there saying this is critical, this is mission critical to the country, and you guys need to step up and protect this.
So, Chris, what's the end game for the bad guys? Is it chaos and a chance for them to rake in some dough, a combination of both? I mean, what do they want?
Well, the way that it looks right now, given that we are essentially in the middle of cyber warfare that are sponsored by nation states, right? This looks to me that the reasons behind these attacks are geopolitical. So if I want to cripple, Oregon, I shut down the port, I shut down the water, I shut down the electricity. And those are attacks one nation state against another. It's not a terrorist saying, ha, 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 or give me money with ransomware. These are very serious infrastructure attacks. So it's a nation state issue, and it needs to be addressed at that. The second level, where we're talking about ransomware and let's close down the port unless the port pays me $10 million, and it happened to the pipeline, right? If you remember, a few months ago, the pipeline was shut down and it costs $4 million in ransomware to restore it. We did get the money back eventually. Same story here. If it is done this way, and it may be disguised to be that way from a nation state as they test our own defenses. So the federal government is stepping up and saying, you can test your defenses all you want. We're going to step up and we're going to protect our mission critical infrastructure in every sector of the government.
Got it, Chris. Great stuff as always. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome. Stay safe out there and have a great weekend.
We shall do that. So that is our cybersecurity expert, author, and president of the New York-based Information Technology Management Group, Chris Moscovides. Finally, a little bit of time left, and a few movies are coming out this weekend. Two new movies on tap for us. With us, our movie critic, Gray Drake. Hi there, Gray.
Hello.
I think I might like both of these, really. So we're going to start with a Coen brother film. This one is Drive Away Dolls.
They know we have their stuff. Maybe we sell it back. Shake them down.
Are they like wanted or something?
Oh no, they're not in trouble at all.
I'm gonna help you break a big murder case.
That is about the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Okay, kind of funny, I hope. What did you think?
Very funny, very quirky. So definitely get ready for that kind of Big Lebowski-esque type humor. Little Blood Simple, Little Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? This one is about Jamie, who's played by Margaret Qualley from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She has just broken up with her girlfriend. She needs an adventure. And her friend Marion, played by Geraldine Viswanathan from Miracle Workers, is super uptight. So she says, let's go on a road trip to Tallahassee. We can do this thing called drive away, where a car needs to be delivered somewhere and you can be the person that takes it there.
It's wrong, right?
I know, right? Well, it turns out there's a package in the car. The bad guys want it. The car was never meant for these girls to take their trip in. And so they're being chased the whole time. And once you figure out what's in the briefcase, you will be shocked and delighted.
Okay.
You will laugh and you will probably be a little embarrassed. And so this is just like a kind of a real Coen Brothers vibe to it. It's a weird little movie. It is not proper in any way. It's very R-rated, so keep that in mind.
Got it, Gray. Okay, up next we have Red Right Hand. This one stars Orlando Bloom.
Three jobs to pay off a debt. Three jobs and I'm done.
It don't matter what you do. I say when it's over.
So some kind of family action? What's the deal?
Well, Legolas, who we love, as you've never seen him before, where he's playing Cash, this man who's done some bad things in his life, and he, at the time that he was doing them, he worked for Big Cat, played by Andy McDowell, who we all love from a million things, but like Groundhog Day, for instance. She's mean in this movie, and Cash is just living with his brother and his brother's daughter, trying to be a good person. But wouldn't you know, his brother confesses that he has borrowed money from Big Cat that he can't pay back. Cash gets pulled back in by her to do only three more jobs, in air quotes. And what you can expect in this one is tons of action in Orlando Bloom. Like I said, you've never seen him like this before. Trust me. So you can rent this one on demand and it's very worth it. This is a lot like Orlando Bloom's Taken.
Great description there. That is Red Right Hand. And that's rentable and also in theaters this week, Driveaway Dolls. Gray, good stuff. Thanks.
You bet.
That is our movie critic, Gray Drake. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines, a behind-the-scenes look at some of this week's stories. You can follow me on Twitter at Brett Recamp. If you missed anything, the podcast is up at KXL.com, and you can download the show on iTunes or Google Play. Just look for Beyond the Headlines KXL. We now have 505 shows to choose from. For Alpha Media USA in downtown Portland, I'm Brett Recamp on FM News 101.
This has been Beyond the Headlines. In-depth interviews on topics of concern here in Portland and the Northwest. This has been a special presentation of Alpha Media.